Welcome to the Speechy Side Up podcast. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. You can follow along on Instagram at Speechy Side Up. This episode is a little different from my other episodes as it's available for ASHA CEUs through TASL. Click on the link in the show notes or go to tasltogether.com to register or stay on until the very end because I'll explain exactly how to earn ASHA CEUs.
So again, 8 ways that we can learn about cultures while simultaneously building relationships, reading about other people's cultures and histories, and not just reading, but, you know, Vanita, just like with yourself, watching that documentary. So some people might not be readers. That's completely fine. I love documentaries. So doing documentaries or watching, watching movies about stories. Now there is one, what sticks out to me is Killers of the Flower Moon. Really listen to what the community is saying about that particular movie, because a lot of people from the indigenous community, and if you're not familiar with Killers of the Flower Moon, it's a Leonardo DiCaprio, but the producer, can't think of his name right now. Robert De Niro.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's Robert De Niro, and he's not indigenous, but of course he, you know, cares about the story. But people from that community said they didn't even want to watch it because they would rather themselves tell the story rather than someone from another community. So that is kind of how you can discern what you should watch. But another one, just for example, Shogun, my dad just had it on and I'm like, oh, wow. And I'm seeing that people from Japan are actually the ones filming this movie and the ones who were on set. And so that would be like your good litmus test to go ahead and watch it and see a little bit about the culture. Listening to people tell their stories. YouTube is excellent. Different TED Talks. Yeah, I love YouTube. TED Talks is a great way. Your colleagues and just listening to them talk about their culture. You know, I love Latin cultures because they will be the first ones to say, yes, I'm Mexican and this is what we do. They, you know, it's a lot of pride in it, which is great. So listen and act accordingly. Notice differences in communication styles and values and not assuming that the majority's way is the right way. So unfortunately, especially when it comes to African-American English, it can come off as if you're not familiar with the dialect or if you don't respect it as a dialect, it can come off as, oh, they're just ignorant or, you know, they must come from a lower income community and we have to fix this grammar, you know, so again, that's when the cultural compatibility comes into play, and it can be very harmful if we're moving with that mindset. Risk making mistakes. We did talk a little bit about that. I know it can be scary, especially if you're coming from, I can just imagine just coming from the majority culture, if you are white, you know, wanting to make that intention to bridge the gaps, but not wanting to step on anyone's toes or offend anyone or being marked as racist or you don't want to make those microaggressions, but that's when you risk making a mistake. And I think we'll have a little bit of time to talk about this in action. And then also listening to people tell their stories. So when they're telling you, hey, that was actually kind of offensive, you know, try not to get offended and just say, okay, I'm so sorry. It was not my intention and I'll do better moving forward. Sorry goes a long way. And learn to be an ally. Learn is the stronger word in here than ally, because allyship is definitely an ongoing process. And, you know, as culture consistently just evolves and evolves, you want to learn how to be it. I think a lot of times we make the mistake of just saying, I am an ally, but I think that there's a bit more than just calling ourselves an ally. It takes learning about the needs of that certain community and culture and how we can be better advocates for them.
I feel like maybe people shouldn't be like self-identifying as an ally either. I feel like that should maybe come from the other culture if they feel like you're being an ally, right? That's just my initial thought. I found the documentary. It's called Growing Up Mixed. I think it's 1000% Me Growing Up Mixed. So if anybody's interested, that's what it's called.
Thank you. Yes. And just quickly about allyship, I talked to Ianessa Humper and she was going through some things in the community and speech, and people reached out to her and said, I just wanted to let you know that I'm an ally. And to her, she said that would be like walking up the street to someone and saying, I just want to let you know that you're my friend. you know, so it's like that. You can't just assume that you're friends with someone. It should be a mutual agreement. So yeah, Vanita, I think you hit the nail on the head with that one.
Okay. That makes sense. Thank you for that illustration, because I think that'll help people understand why. All right. So tell us more about this scenario.
So I did want to include the scenario just so we can learn how we can really put it into practice and just take risks. So there's a concept in Hispanic cultures called familismo. And I got this from Joan Payne, 2011. And it is not unusual for an entire Hispanic family to be involved in healthcare decisions of an older family member. Familismo is the unifying cultural theme that the needs of the family as a whole should be the priority. So Mrs. A.S. has been diagnosed to have a right hemisphere hemorrhagic stroke with accompanying disorders of left side neglect and difficulties with abstract reasoning. Before scheduling outpatient treatment in the speech and hearing clinic, the SLP asked to meet with the family, which includes the patient's husband, father, mother, siblings, and children. Failing to recognize the hierarchical position of the eldest male in the family, the clinician addressed the patient's husband. He, in turn, deferred to his wife's father, who spoke on behalf of the family. So I want everyone listening to this to really just think, how would you practice cultural compatibility in this scenario? And then also just considering the 8 ways that we could build relationships with multicultural communities, what would you do and how would you respond?
I love how you always put everybody on the spot.
Yeah, I know, I know, I know. So, you know,
we did this in our last interview too.
Yeah, just something to think about, just food for thought. And I do have in the next slide just some ideas for you.
Oh, okay.
To keep in mind. Yes, 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 yes. So, yes, I was going to do that to you today, Vanita. So, yes, how would you respond? First of all, don't be ashamed. Oh, my goodness. I have made a lot of cultural mistakes. I worked at a clinic where we served all Spanish families, and I have made so many mistakes. And I would feel that energy of shame, like, and then just embarrassment. But really, just you can be proud of yourself for taking that positive risk. And also respectfully respond to the sociocultural cues. So, and by sociocultural, I really mean like social and cultural. So that social cue of, let me talk to my wife's father, don't talk to me. That's your social skill to just simply do it. And cultural, because that's them actually telling you, this is how it works in our culture, don't talk to me. You know, that they didn't say that explicitly, but that's exactly what the body language and the entire situation told you. You can be proud of taking that risk and also show gratitude for the feedback. So this could either be when you go to your office and just say, you know what, thank God that this happened and they were graceful about it, or maybe they might not have been graceful about it, but thank God this happened so that way it won't happen again. Or even just telling to the client, oh wow, thank you so much for redirecting me, and then move forward. And then intentionally set time aside to learn more. So this is also why it is important to have friends in the community. Do not tokenize anybody, but you know, really just make sure that you are placing yourself in the communities where you really aspire to grow and learn more about them.
Awesome. These are great suggestions. Thank you for that. Thank you for giving us the answers.
Yes, yes, yes. I did quickly just want to talk about immigration detainment centers, because I think that that's something that we don't necessarily consider. And sometimes families don't just straight up tell us, hey, I am a survivor of a detainment center, or my child is. So this is just something that we should consider as speech pathologists, the experiences and children of families who are experiencing trauma from immigration detainment centers or separation at the border. That's when trauma-informed care really needs to apply here, because is a child not speaking because they have an expressive language disorder, or are they not speaking because they're actually just traumatized? And unfortunately, maybe someone at the detainment center looked like you, and now they're generalizing it in their own heads, and they don't want to speak, and they don't want to open up to anybody in their immediate environment. So these are just things to keep in mind.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that. And we've had Rachel, the PTSD SLP, come on and talk about trauma-informed care with us. But is that something that you talk about as well, trauma-informed care?
Yes, I'm really passionate about it. And I love that how you mentioned Rachel, because we did actually want to collaborate on something when it comes to, yeah, immigration detainee camps. So just look out for that.
Awesome.
Yes. So principles of ethics, this is the most important part, like the foundations of everything we do. ASHA does mandate cultural compatibility. No, they don't necessarily call it cultural compatibility yet, but they do have points on ethics with cultural competency and cultural humility. So principle of ethics one says that we should honor our responsibility to hold paramount the welfare of the people that we serve professionally or who are participants in research and scholarly activities. So that does also include the students who we are serving as well, and just making sure that their welfare is good. We can risk jeopardizing our clients or students' welfare by not taking the time to understand each other's unique cultural characteristics.
Mm-hmm. Is that your interpretation of that ethics, or is that part of that?
Oh, that's my interpretation. Thank you for clarifying. Okay. That's my, yeah, that's not part of the ethics, no.
No, but it makes sense that it's like a translation of that.
Mm-hmm. Rule of Ethics 2A says that we should only engage in aspects of professions that are within our scope of professional practice and competence, considering our certification status, education, training, and experience. So just as a quick example, if you're not really familiar with working with children who are deaf and hard of hearing, do not treat that patient. You can either refer them out to someone who is familiar with them, or take the time to get the necessary training to, you know, to move forward. Otherwise, you are being unethical and you can put them at further harm.
Yeah, thank you for that example.
Mm-hmm. Also, principle of ethics 2 says individuals shall honor our responsibility to achieve and maintain the highest level of professional competence and performance. This is, again, just saying it is up to us to practice at the top of our licenses. And the way that we practice at the top of our licenses is being culturally competent and practicing this cultural compatibility. Benita, we do got to get those stats, because we do work with majorly people from different cultures. So this is how we can make sure that we are uplifting the profession.
Yeah. Does it not bother you? Do you wish that the word cultural would be in there? Because like that competence is so general, right? Mm-hmm. It's not specific at all, but I feel like it needs to be held to the higher standard. The fact that cultural should be in there and it's not.
I agree. I definitely agree. I will say that this is on their website under cultural competence. And then they do talk about the ethics. Yeah. So it is there, but I do agree. I think it should also be embedded in this principle.
Yeah, I think so too.
So just to dig a little bit deeper in ethics two, Rule C says that we shall enhance and refine our professional competence and expertise through engagement and lifelong learning applicable to our professional activities and skills. So you can do that by taking into consideration the 8 steps to cultivating relationships with multicultural communities. Those are all great ways to do it. I did want to include this Reg Reavens quote that says, "There can be no learning without action and no action without learning." So it's great that we are attending webinars and courses, but after that, we have to take the additional step to implement everything that we've learned.
Yeah, that makes sense. While you were sharing that, I was trying to look up the statistics through ASHA. And just as at a quick glance, since we don't have a ton of time to do research on this prior to the end of this presentation, they have the population density in here. So. Okay. The population that we serve, 27% in city or urban areas, 30% in suburban areas, 38% in rural areas in regards to autism. And then they break it down, but swallowing and feeding, speech sound disorders. But of course, the city and urban areas are higher, and they're all around that 30%. in regards to the suburban, they're also around that 30%. And the other one is the rural. So it's almost like split in thirds, it seems. But the highest is the city and urban areas, for sure. This is a long document, so it might get into cultural backgrounds too. No, I got to the bottom. Didn't have the cultural backgrounds, but we'll have to definitely get that information because I hate leaving people hanging without it.
Yes, yes, and thank you. I mean, I was definitely taking notes on that, but it puts things into perspective. But yes, let's get that, because I think if we even have that in our minds, we can understand how we can be better service to these children. Yeah, so
absolutely.
And I always speak in children's terms because I'm a pediatric SLP, but the adults that we served also.
That's true.
So principle of ethics 3, individuals shall uphold the dignity and autonomy of the professions, maintain collaborative and harmonious interprofessional and intra-professional relationships, and accept the profession's self-imposed standards. So in a nutshell, we uphold the dignity of speech pathology by taking the CEUs, by watching podcasts and presentations just like this one, and by putting it into practice and really creating safe spaces for our colleagues of other professions, our colleagues within speech pathology, and the families and clients who we serve. Accepting the profession's self-imposed standards. And really what I think of when I think of accept is just simply doing it. Just do it. You know, if this is what ASHA put out, they even renewed it for us in 2023, then this is something that we should also take seriously. Rule of Ethics 3, Principle of Ethics 3 goes further to Rule M. And this is telling us that we should not discriminate in our relationships with colleagues, assistants, students, support personnel, and this means those paraprofessionals. This also means interpreters and members of other professions and disciplines on the basis of race, ethnicity, sex, gender identity or expression, sexual orientation, age, religion, national origin, disability, culture, language, dialect, or socioeconomic status. So a lot of us might be watching this and be like, well, I mean, of course, why would I discriminate against anyone? But it's so interesting how implicit bias works. You don't even realize that you're doing it. If there is someone or a student, I've gotten students who've come up to me, and these are like graduate students, who've come up to me and said, yes, I have cerebral palsy, or yes, I came from another country, so English is my second language. And these professors didn't necessarily give me the same opportunities as they did my other colleagues. And so we might be doing things that we don't realize that we're doing, but it's definitely felt for the people who are affected. So just again, making sure that you're keeping this in mind, it would be unethical for us to intentionally do it, of course. But for those who are just genuine in spirit with everything that they do, make sure that you are going and doing your research and just continuing to learn more about different cultures.
So now let's talk about how this plays into supervision.
Yes. So how can we practice cultural compatibility as supervisors? So I'm currently a supervisor for a graduate student. But this also applies to our SLPAs as well. So first of all, get curious about your own culture. Create space for your students and colleagues, right? Because we should really look at SLPAs as colleagues. Unfortunately, that's not always done. So I just felt a need to say that. But creating space for our students and colleagues to be proud of their own cultures and to be proud of their own expression. So even, let's just say specifically, if they have a different gender expression, be proud of that because that's who they are. That's how they identify. Educating our students on ways they can recognize how their differences are vehicles to making genuine connections. Being open to dialogue. And again, I'll say this until the cows come home, checking our implicit biases, encouraging colleagues and students to do the same, especially when it comes to race and ethnicity, gender expression, disability. I did include, ASHA does provide resources on this and how we can continue to check our implicit biases, the personal reflection checklist, and then upholding the ASHA code of ethics.
Do you want to touch on
really briefly the conversations around maintaining the ASHA membership right now?
Sure.
Because I know people are thinking this. Like,
Yes. I've been very quiet about this debate, actually, because, you know, in my opinion, $25, I understand why people are upset with ASHA, because we have really been fighting for, just for example, higher pay. Mm-hmm. So it does feel like a slap in the face when we've been advocating for ourselves to get higher pay and to be taken seriously in our workplace settings, and then they add on an extra $25. I get that. At the same time, I really appreciate having that CCC after my name, not just an ego thing, for example, but also I think it actually helps clients feel more comfortable with us. And that's one of the ways that we are able to be taken seriously, because speech pathology really is still such a baby field. And so having those C's is necessary. It helps people know this is specifically what I am trained in. And nationwide, I can move forward with these skills that I've learned. I hope that answered your question. So yeah, that definitely a controversial topic. You put me on the spot with that one.
Yeah, but, no, and I think it's a personal decision for everybody. Yeah. And I think everyone should be respectful that what you decide, what I decide is a personal decision. I was kind of getting at the post that I saw from Unlearn With Me SLP, because I think it was a really good perspective for people that are not aware that, and because we're talking about the ethical standards, which were put out by ASHA, that there's protection in those ethical standards for our diverse communities and for our SLPs, like within their work settings. If we don't have those ethical standards, then really colleagues don't have to abide by those at all. And you know what I mean? That's kind of what I think she was getting at, but I could be misinterpreting it.
Yeah, I'll actually have to go back and look at that post. But yes, you know, if this is how we're able, you know, because being members of ASHA means that we are required to continue to take certain CEU courses. And I could be speaking out of ignorance. Maybe I know we still have to do that when we're certified by our states too, but ASHA does have a great way of keeping us accountable. So,
yeah. All right. So what are these main principles of ethics that talk about supervision?
Yes. So a lot of them really are the same, as I mentioned before, of course, holding paramount the welfare of the people that we serve. Rule A of Ethics 1 says individuals shall provide all clinical services and scientific activities competently. And Rule C says discrimination exhibited by the SLPA could be violation of the code. So if you notice your SLPA or graduate students, student clinicians, discriminating against anybody in any way, nipping it in the bud, and not only nipping it in the bud, but you can nip it in the bud by providing education for them, because they could be in the same boat of not realizing that they're doing it. Mm-hmm. Also, if you are a clinical supervisor for graduate students, in Calypso, or one of the things that they're evaluated on is actually their cultural competency. And so it is up to us to provide that education for them. Unfortunately, the universities don't always do that. But if you are intentional in raising future clinicians or future certified clinicians, then that's a great next step in making sure that you're being ethical in your supervision. A little bit deeper on Rule C, individuals shall not discriminate in their relationship with colleagues, assistants, students, support personnel, and members of other professions. I already talked about this, but the reason why I wanted to have this up on the screen is just so we can understand the specifics, the race, the ethnicity, the sex, the gender, sexual orientation, age, religion is really important, because if, let's just say, for example, you have a colleague or you have a graduate student who is openly saying, I'm agnostic, or I'm actually more into science, being sure that you aren't treating them any other way, any kind of way, because of that. National origin, disability, culture, language, dialect. That's when we talked about AAE. That's when we talked about the Spanish dialects, and also different dialects within Asian languages. or socioeconomic status. If you have an assistant or a student who's like, hey, I'm actually coming to the city from a rural area, I might need an extra, I might need a 10-minute grace period or a 15-minute grace period. Of course, you can set those boundaries so that way you can still keep things professional. At the same time, showing grace because certain things, they have certain difficulties because of their identity and because of their experiences. Okay. Ethics 4 Rule J says, individuals shall not knowingly allow anyone under their supervision to engage in any practice that violates the code of ethics. So again, just ensuring your supervisees are intentionally engaging in cultural compatibility, sending them this presentation, sending them any other presentations that you know, if you just happen to be scrolling online. I know, for example, with me, I just happen to be scrolling and I see free L classes and then I just send it to my students, you know, so they're just planting little seeds and nuggets so that way they can enhance their cultural compatibility. As certified SLPs, we're really privileged and we have a lot of access to information that assistants or of course students might not have. So yeah, it's up to us to kind of pass the information down for them. So what is culture? The reason why we wanted to talk about what is culture is because we cannot understand other people's cultures if we can't even understand our own and how we identify. It's easy to just move through life, and especially as a majority, or for example, like what you said, colleagues who are coming from those rural communities and everyone looks like them, everyone has a similar culture, so you don't really have to think about it. So, but it's still necessary to say, I do come from those rural communities and I did grow up with other people from rural communities and other people who are white, and I may have only seen one or two Black people. If you can own that experience of yours and show respect to yourself for that experience of yours, then you're able to make the necessary steps forward, because life won't always be the same. As we know, life constantly evolves and new people are brought into our spaces. And so if you can say, I've grown up with only two people, and in my town, there's only a few people who identify as people of color, and I actually don't see anyone who identifies as trans, but now all of a sudden I'm getting this one client who is. You can own and accept that experience and then move forward in a sense of, let me educate myself because I actually know nothing about this. So your challenge is to take some time to reflect on your own culture. Maria Axner does provide an exercise to help us reflect on our own culture and intersections. And I did just put this in the slide because this is part of the exercise. So really just thinking about, what is your race? What is your religion? Your nationality? Even the nationality of your ancestors can go a long way. Your age, geographic locations, gender, are you non-binary, are you disabled, where are you coming from, a rural or urban area, are you a parent, are you a student, did you grow up in a military household, were you in the military, do you consider yourself poor or in an impoverished area, have you ever been to prison or has anyone in your immediate family ever been to prison, would you consider yourself wealthier, in the middle class or in the working class? So understanding our backgrounds and also the backgrounds of the people who raised us, including teachers, because they kind of raised us, can really help you move forward in the best way for our client.
So is there anything that we're supposed to do with this information, or is it just like reflecting on our culture? What do we do with that information afterwards?
That's a great question. It's mainly reflecting on your culture and then also asking yourself those critical self-reflective questions on how that could affect how you look at other races. Mm-hmm. So one exercise I love to do, and as I've been getting deeper into this work, I've noticed it come up because I do have my own implicit biases. I grew up in America, so I'm going to have them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as they come up, if I notice it within myself, I actually did this the other night. I took time to journal about it. This is actually what's coming up when I think about this group of people. I've actually written down certain things and I've tied it to where they came from. And that really goes a long way, because then this is the foundational process, then you can move forward and change your perspective.
That's helpful.
There's a lot of power in that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like this exercise too, because I think sometimes we think like, well, what does culture actually entail? And that kind of shows all of the aspects of it.
Yeah, exactly. Because we, you know, a lot of times I think we're trained to kind of think in black, white, or, you know, even, you know, thinking about the LGBTQ community. But a lot of times we leave out people with disabilities, or, I mean, I've even been guilty of this, leaving out religion, because there's a lot of culture within religion. So I did want to talk a little bit about intersectionality, because we don't just have one culture, we have more than one. And the way that Kimberly Crenshaw explained it is intersectionality is how systems of oppression overlap to create distinct experiences for people with multiple identity categories. So she says to think of our cultures like roads and how they intersect. So for example, I am a Black woman with ADHD. That's three cultures right there, okay? So I've had certain challenges and triumphs, but I'm definitely a lot of challenges navigating the healthcare system. Derek Daniels is a speech pathologist in Michigan at the time where I did this research, and he discusses his experience as a Black man and as a person who stutters. And he says that he's had to learn how to be resilient through racism, ableism, and also homophobic situations. So this is where it is important to just consider all of the identities that someone identifies as.
And what is implicit bias?
Yeah, so now we're on implicit bias. Mm-hmm. And I did talk a little bit about after you discover what your culture is, you can take the next step to identify how your experiences might have created some implicit biases. No one's fault, just the nature of society. So implicit bias, a form of bias that occurs automatically and unintentionally, that nevertheless affects judgments, decisions, and behaviors. We might not realize we're having these biases, but as healthcare professionals who are devoted to lifelong learning and work directly with multicultural groups, it is critical that we explore our own biases and how they affect our interpersonal interactions. So I did include Harvard's implicit association test. That's a really popular one, but you can just go online and search implicit bias tests if you don't resonate with Harvard universities. And actually that is a great way to, build reliability and validity with this specific test is take this test and then take another test and see if it's consistent.
Well, that's a great tip.
Mm-hmm. It just came to mind.
So, don't you love that?
Yeah, I know. Ooh, that'll be fun. So culture and cultural diversity. I explained a bit about this throughout this whole presentation. So just understanding that it includes so many different factors. Your national origin, your ancestry, your language, your dialect, citizenship, your religion, your sex, your veteran status, and also linguistic diversity can accompany cultural diversity as well. Linguistic diversity is so important to recognize, of course, as speech pathologists, second language acquisition, dialectal differences, bilingualism includes various dialects and languages that we can all appreciate. So we should definitely consider people who are coming from diverse linguistic backgrounds, Spanish, English, Chinese, and African-American English, linguistic diversity existing within a culture, Spanish dialects, including Castilian Spanish and Caribbean Spanish and Central American Spanish. I will say that, oh my goodness, Benita, I learned Spanish in Latin America. I learned Spanish in Guatemala, and I just got a client and they're from Cuba. So they thank God the mother is in the session, because I have to ask, how do you say this in Cuba? How do you say this? Because the word I have is very different from the word that you're probably saying at home. So just as a side note, you know, that's something where I have to go out of my way. I'm definitely, and I'm excited to do it, but intentionally learn more about Cuban Spanish, the history of it, going and looking at videos of people who speak Cuban Spanish, and then collaborating with the family to make sure that everything I am teaching to their child is carrying over into the home setting.
Yeah, it's just not Spanish. There's so many different dialectical differences right within that.
Oh yeah. And you might hear my dog bark pretty soon. There's a big truck that just came outside. Oh. Here we go. Yes. Yes. So lastly, on culture and cultural diversity, implicit bias and intersectionality that we just discussed, you know, just really continuously challenging our own biases and exploring ways that intersectionality shows up in your reality. So for example, if you identify as a white Christian woman, there are also ways that white Christian women are marginalized. First of all, being a woman in society and those different stereotypes as being a woman, being a Christian and the different stereotypes of being Christian. You know, there are times when Christians are not, even though we're in a presumably majority society of Christian people, there are environments and ways that being Christian is not welcome. And so I'm just also taking that into consideration for yourself also. Intentionally discovering ways that intersectionality impacts the lives of the people that we serve. So again, really looking at those marginalized communities, specifically, just for example, if they're Black and coming from lower socioeconomic status and they speak African-American English, they might not get the same opportunities that someone else of more privilege might get. And they might be coming from different traumas as well because of that.
So why is it important?
So here is why learning about our own cultures and implicit beliefs are important. First of all, we need to understand what we bring to the table. Okay, I always say, be proud of your identity and your values, your backgrounds and beliefs. Of course, if there are restrictions there, for example, just different stereotypes. If you don't think that a certain culture is capable of something, that's where you would need to change, right? That's where you should open your mind. But if you have certain values and beliefs that are more so uplifting to your culture, own that and celebrate it. And that helps us hold space for others to show up as their authentic selves as well. Again, checking our implicit biases and showing ourselves grace when we fall short. It's not, you know, we're not going to be perfect. There are so many people in this world and there are so many cultures in this world and ways of thinking. And so when we fall short, of course, it's not an excuse, but as ways to nourish our soil for growth. So just going back to my example with the Cuban Spanish client I have, or the client who speaks Cuban Spanish. Oh my goodness, I made so many mistakes during that call and I was sweating. but it was great because I got to learn and now I know, okay, well, let me go ahead and nourish my soil. Let me watch some more videos and do some trainings. And eventually I'll put it on my bucket list to go to Cuba and do an immersive experience there. Mm-hmm. So yes. And also recognizing that you're also a part of this melting pot and can appreciate the differences other people have. Again, just going back to recognizing what we bring to the table, you know, just celebrating ourselves so that way we can better celebrate others.
I love that. And you include all of these amazing references. Thank you for that. Everybody who's here can see the PowerPoint or print out the PowerPoint so they can look at those references on their own time, but that's a very comprehensive list. So I appreciate it. Melanie, this has been incredible. I always love talking with you because you do leave a lot of room for grace and you're always open to hearing my questions and breaking things down and explaining it. So thank you for always being willing to have the conversations. And I know that people are going to want to connect with you and follow you after this. So where are the best places?
Yes. And also, I just have to say thank you, Vanita, for opening space for this conversation. You always open space for this conversation to happen. So thank you also. If you are looking for questions, resources, and tips, you can find me a few ways. I have a YouTube network, Pediatric Speech Sister Network, and that's where I meet with different people from various cultures. It's called the Pediatric Speech Sister Show. And we talk about ways that we can be more culturally responsive in our workplaces, communities, and just day-to-day lives. Check that out. You can check me out on Instagram where I have tips and even free resources on there. If you want to email me, contact@pediatricspeechsister.com is my email address. You can find me on LinkedIn. And also, I do have a podcast, the Pediatric Speech Sister Show podcast, and you can find me on all major podcast platforms.
Amazing. And one day I'll get on there. We have tried and tried so many times to coordinate an interview for vice versa. She's been on the Speechy Side Out podcast, but to go back on to yours and hopefully we can make that happen one day. But thank you again, Melanie. This was amazing.
Yes. Yes, of course. Thank you.
Wasn't that amazing? This episode is part of a two-part PodCourse series. As a reminder, listening to this episode does not automatically guarantee ASHA CEUs. If you want to earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs, then make sure you listen to part one and two, then click on the link in the show notes or go to tasseltogether.com to register for this featured course or an SLP Connect membership. Pass a brief quiz and achieve an 80% or higher score. Finish the program evaluation and pass the quiz by the end date indicated on the course details page. Make sure you provided your ASHA information when you registered, and then TASSEL will automatically report your course participation to ASHA. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this pod course sponsored by TASSEL.